there are two rates that we look at. There's one, which is our estimated headline tariff rate that assumes that 2024 imports stay constant, right? And that's around 18 to 19%. That's the number that you see when you read the news, see most reports. That has ground up from 2.3% at the start of this year. So that's a very significant shift.
Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm Gabriela Santos, Chief Market Strategist for the Americas here at JP Morgan Asset Management. This year, we've been spending time on Insights Now, sitting down with our research analysts across JP Morgan Asset Management. First on the equity side, then in fixed income, and this season, we're chatting with multi-asset research analysts. They spend their time doing research on how tactical and strategic asset allocation should adapt to a variety of environments, shifting macroeconomic and policy environments, different desired investment outcomes, such as retirement, and across different investing styles, including fundamental and quantitative investing. On this episode of Insights Now, I'll be joined by Gang Narbunanand, research analyst on our multi-asset solutions team. Gang joined us at JP Morgan Asset Management in April to focus his research on the evolving policy landscape and its implications for macroeconomic research and for investment strategy. He joined us from the U.S. Department of Treasury, where he was Deputy Chief of Staff, advising Secretary Janet Yellen on domestic and international economic policy and strategic matters. I'm very excited to ask Gang about why policy right now is such an essential component of tactical and strategic investment processes. I'll also ask him his latest views on all things fiscal, trade, and regulatory policy and the economic and market impacts he expects to see ahead. If you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can now watch along on YouTube by tuning in to our JP Morgan Asset Management channel linked in the show notes. Now let's get started. Gang, welcome to Insights Now.
Thank you, Gabby. How are you?
Good, good. Doing really, really well. I've been excited to talk to you.
Thank you.
And the number one question I have is, why exactly right now is policy so important for investors to take into account when they think about asset allocation?
Yeah, so let me talk about kind of my perspective as an asset allocator. You know, we both know that asset allocation is the most important thing that investors can do for their portfolios, right? The right asset allocation. And of course, that's not easy to do. One of the biggest inputs is where you are in the macro cycle. If you can understand where you are in kind of the macro regime, the transitions, the anticipate the surprises, especially against market expectations, that puts you in a very good place when determining the asset class allocations. I think investors have long appreciated the importance of monetary policy, but I think other types of policy, whether it's fiscal policy, foreign policy, regulatory policy, they haven't appreciated just as much. And I think part of that is because in the 2010s, we had a period of what I like to call monetary activism. So in that period, basically, central banks were in the driver's seat. The political governments had their, you know, their wallets shut. This was the age of austerity. They were really in the passenger seat. Enter COVID, 2020. You know, I was involved in implementing a $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package during COVID called the American Rescue Plan. And since then, seems like the opposite has happened, right? The political governments with their fiscal spending are now in the driver's seat, and the central banks are reacting to that. They're in the passenger seat. And so we're in a period of fiscal activism rather than monetary activism, in addition to other themes we've talked about before on economic nationalism that we see in tariffs and the like. And so I think because of that, understanding the suite of policies, not just monetary policy, but fiscal policy, trade policy, and the like, is just essential to understanding where you are in the cycle, understanding the directional and relative value trades that you can make.
And it's interesting that all those themes now very much apply to the U.S., where before maybe it was thought about just for, I don't know, certain emerging markets.
Right.
So definitely a lot to wrap our heads around for the U.S. And we certainly had quite a lot of a policy storm just this year alone. And we're trying to understand where we've settled and what the ultimate macroeconomic impacts could be. With fiscal policy, it seems like we've seen already a lot of information. We've gotten the passage of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
Right.
So what are your key takeaways from the bill and where we are with fiscal policy?
Yeah, I think, you know, the One Big Beautiful Bill is one big deal, right? And I like to think of it as almost like a shot of caffeine. You know, you get that stimulative effect. It does come at a cost. For caffeine, you get that crash after. That's why I don't drink coffee, by the way.
Impressive.
Yeah, only tea. And in this case, it comes at the cost of higher debt levels. And that's something that we should talk about at some point. But maybe let me just start with kind of the macro short-term stimulative effect. We think it's really going to hit in the first half of 2026. That's when consumers are really going to get, Americans are going to get these tax refunds, right? And so we think that that will help normalize the economy from the period of the tariff drag that we see hitting really in the second half of this year. There are two caveats that I would place on that. Number one is that there is a stimulative effect. It's significant, but it's not overwhelming. And the reason is because if you look at 2026 spending overall from the bill, half of it is actually an extension of the TCJA tax bill that was passed in 2017. And so it's not essentially new spending on top of the current policy if you assume that that's been extended. And so only half, about 250, is really kind of new spending on top of that. So that's the magnitude. The other thing that I would point out is the distributional impacts. And so if you actually look at the bill and how it's impacting Americans of different quintiles, upper middle and upper income Americans are going to get the most benefit from this bill. If you look at lower income Americans, the benefits much less and sometimes none at all, you know, particularly for those who don't actually owe any taxes in the first place. And so the reason I mention that is because lower income Americans are where we look at Chase credit card data, where we see Americans hurting. They're still doing okay, but that's where cracks are starting to emerge. Lower income Americans are the ones who are going to be hit most by the tariff impact, and they're the ones who benefit least from this bill. And actually, you know, if you go down the line into when the Medicaid cuts actually take effect, they actually lose resources from this bill. So that doesn't mean it's not going to have a stimulus effect. It will have a similar effect, but I just wanted to point out a couple caveats. This is more like a shot of caffeine, not like a, you know, nine shots of caffeine, if you will.
And not everyone gets the same.
Exactly. That's right.
Anything interesting there on the corporate side for you?
Yeah. So on the corporate side, of course, there's kind of three main, or now three to four main kind of corporate tax depreciation provisions. The most surprising thing for me was that it came out disappointing my expectations on the corporate side. On the consumer side, it exceeded expectations in terms of the magnitude, but on the corporate side, actually kind of disappointed.
How interesting. Yeah. Speaking of the topic you brought up just now, fiscal responsibility, very much top of mind for investors. And ultimately, it's really the deficit and debt trajectories. How do you think about it, and how do you think investors should think about it?
I think it's one of the biggest concerns that we face as a country when you think longer term. Maybe I can just throw out a few facts and start there. Right now, debt to GDP is about 100%. The CBO, which is the Congressional Budget Office, really gold standard kind of projectors, their baseline trajectory is that in 10 years, that's going to increase to 119%. So from 100% to 119% in 10 years. And our current deficit levels are at around 5 to 6% of GDP. So those are the numbers. They're significant. They're concerning in their own right. But here's what makes it more concerning. Number one, we're in a full employment economy, right? The unemployment rate, as you know, is 4.2%.
Yeah.
So this is not a recessionary, you know, situation where we need to stimulate the economy, and so therefore we're spending more than we typically will. This is kind of steady state, and it's that high, number one. Number two, we're in a higher interest rate environment. And so if interest rates structurally are going to be higher than they were, say, over the past 10 years, then that provides additional concern on how we're going to service that debt going into the future. And then number three is that there's the, of course, the fiscal impact of the OBBB. And that's estimated around 3.4 trillion over 10 years. If you include interest into that, it's more about 4 trillion. So that's going to add on to that debt load, right? And, you know, I see a lot of people saying, hey, tariff revenue will offset part of that. That's true. And we're seeing tariff revenue come in at a significant amount. But remember, like, tariffs also shrink the economy. And also, tariff revenue is not necessarily completely certain, right? Mm-hmm. Tariff policy can change. A next administration could change it. And so you got to discount that revenue quite a bit, in my opinion. And that's how we're approaching things. I would also just mention that's on the demand side. We know that we're going to have to issue more treasuries in order to finance our debt. How about the demands? Who's going to actually buy the treasuries? And here is where we're still seeing solid demand for treasuries when you look at auction data. But behind the kind of the veil, you're seeing that the more price insensitive buyers, so these are like foreign official institutions, these are folks who really don't care about the price, they just want to be in treasuries, versus investors like us who are price sensitive, we're looking for opportunity across. The price insensitive buyers, as a percent of buyers of duration, have gone from 60% to about 30% over the past 10 to 15 years. So what that means for investors is that we're probably going to see higher interest rates, higher yields, and probably more volatile yields because price sensitive buyers are now a bigger share. I would just end with this, which is, this is ultimately a political problem. This is not an immutable law of nature that can't be changed, right? Our fiscal trajectory. But it's like a game of hot potato between the two parties, between the Democratic Party and Republican Party. When one is in office, the other cares about fiscal sustainability. And then when they're in office, they don't. And so this is a political will issue. And what I am afraid of is that there's not political will to do something unless there's a mini crisis. And we don't think that a Liz Truss moment in the U.S. will come, say, anytime soon. But it may take a mini crisis in order to get our political leaders to really address this head on.
Especially because there are no easy fixes, right? You really would have to deal with entitlement spending, maybe raise taxes.
Exactly, and a combination of both. I mean, the only kind of real free lunch here is that if you get productivity growth that increases the size of the economy, which reduces the debt to GDP ratio, but you got to get significant productivity growth. And that's a big question mark, right? Can AI, can other technologies really get us to that productivity boom?
Yeah. And interesting, I mean, not many crises at the moment, but certainly has important portfolio implications nonetheless. You mentioned tariff revenue. And speaking of an area with a lot of change, trade policy, especially around tariff rates. So where have we settled now with tariffs? Are we in the all clear? What do you think?
I don't think we're in the all clear. I think we have maybe settled at some place now. The risks are still on the horizon. And we can talk about risk, but maybe a bit about where we are now.
Yes.
There are two rates that we look at. There's one, which is our estimated headline tariff rate that assumes that 2024 imports stay constant, right? And that's around 18 to 19%. That's the number that you see when you read the news, see most reports. That has ground up to from 2.3% at the start of this year. So that's a very significant shift. The number that we look at more closely is what you mentioned, which is tariff revenue that the Treasury Department's actually getting in. As a former Treasury guy, I love the Treasury Daily Statement, the Treasury Monthly Statement. It's a little geeky of me. But there's a lot of important information in there, including tariff revenue. And if you look at those numbers, they're coming in at around 9 to 10%. The tariff rate. Now, that's going to grind higher. The reason it's lower than the estimated headline tariff rate, of course, part of it is consumer substitution. Consumers are buying goods from lower tariff countries versus higher tariff countries. And companies are being creative, right? Like companies are, I spend a lot of time talking to customs brokers and the trade community. And what I hear is, companies filling out USMCA compliance paperwork, right, at very high rates. You have companies better doing inventory management, using bonded warehouses, using duty mitigation programs. And so that's why that rate is at maybe around a 9 to 10%. We think that's going to grind higher as some of the front loading actually wears off and people need to buy from higher tariff countries, and probably will be somewhere in the mid-teens. But there's still kind of risks on the horizon when we think about tariffs.
Which ones do you still think are coming down the pike?
Yeah, so there are a few, and let me start by saying, the tariff issue, the trade issue, you'll remember from Trump 1.0, that didn't go away.
Yeah.
The only reason it went away was COVID hit in March of 2020. So we think that this is a lingering issue, and one thing that one risk that we look at is sectoral tariffs. So these are tariffs on strategic industries. We know pharma tariffs are coming. We know that semiconductor tariffs are coming. The big question on the semiconductor tariffs is whether the tariffs will be on just the semiconductors or also products with semiconductors in them. That would significantly increase the scope. And so we're closely monitoring those in addition to other 232 national security investigations that are going on. A couple other risks on the horizon. Number one is deals falling apart. It's really hard, and I know this from experience, turning a verbal deal into a written document with all the details. And so you could see, the president threatening or actually raising tariff rates if deals fall apart. And the second thing I would say is around the tariffs that are being more used as a geopolitical tool. And I think that when you actually look at the rationale for tariffs, we have recently added one more in, which is tariffs as a geopolitical tool, whether it's in the Thai-Cambodia ceasefire, whether it's on digital service taxes, whether it's on Russia secondary tariffs. So that could expand the use and scope of tariffs.
Yeah, or just certain political developments in certain countries, like with Brazil and its previous president. It just seems like the go-to tool, right?
Exactly. It's the tool of choice.
For the administration.
And one last thing I'll say about tariffs is that it's also important to look beyond the short term about where the tariff rate's going to land to kind of longer term. What kind of trading system are we building? There used to be a trading system that was based on rules, which is the WTO, principles like MFN. Now it's turned into more of a power-based system, right? And so there are going to be winners and losers when we think about investing from that new system. And that's something that we are focused on as well.
And ultimately, as the year goes on and you get those actual effective tariff rates closer to that mid-teens number, what do you ultimately think the economic impact's going to be this year and maybe even longer term?
Yeah, I think policy flowing through to the economy is like planting a seed. It takes time for it to actually develop, and so we're actually just starting to see the seeds that were planted from a tariff perspective in the spring really come to fruit in the fall. And so we think that in the fall, there's going to be data. We're already seeing it in CPI. We're already seeing it in the non-farm payrolls labor data. And we're going to see more of that. So our projections are for by the end of the year, inflation in the mid-threes and growth going down to something more like 1%. And then the economy then renormalizing as some of the base effects start to evaporate and as the fiscal stimulus kicks in.
And it's interesting to think about that we've talked a lot about really important changes on fiscal policy, on trade policy. But there's a third important element of this administration's agenda, which is deregulation.
Yes.
And that seems harder to, I guess, pinpoint specifically,
right?
Or how do you think about how that's actually showing up?
Right. I think that investors often thought before the administration started that Trump 2.0 deregulation would be basically the same as Trump 1.0 deregulation. And that's actually not been true. Trump 2.0 deregulation has been more aggressive, faster, harder than Trump 1.0. And here's a few kind of reasons why. Number one is regulation by termination, or rather deregulation by termination, right? You know, you can rescind rules and go through that process, but you can also just terminate people in the agencies who are in charge of enforcing those rules. And we see that in places like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, where, you know, large swaths of the agency has been terminated. And so that's one way in which they are going harder and faster than in Trump 1.0. They've also had rules come out that says for every one regulation developed, you have to rescind 10 regulations versus two regulations during Trump 1.0. And then interestingly enough, there's a new kind of novel legal approach that they are testing, which is that typically when you deregulate, so you rescind a rule, you kind of have to go through the same process as when you promulgate or enact a rule. And so that's notice and comment. That's, you know, giving an opportunity to the public to actually comment. What this does is it elongates the time that it takes to actually deregulate. What they're saying is that if they deem a rule unlawful or unconstitutional, inconsistent with Supreme Court precedent, they can just rescind it without going through those procedures. And so that's going to increase the speed of deregulation. One area where we've already seen deregulation take place is the financial sector. And I think that's why we have seen, financials performance. And, we saw that with the SLR proposal and more is coming.
And in terms of the first type of really rapid deregulation, do you think that's just something over time ends up showing up in, let's say, more ease of doing business or lower costs for small businesses? How do you?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the type of deregulation. The way we often look at it as more of a relative value issue, right? So when we're making sector bets, say look at financials versus consumer staples, consumer discretionary, that's where we look at the impact of regulations on specific industries, specific sectors, because that's going to vary.
It's super interesting.
Yeah.
Looking for industry-leading insights on markets and the economy? Our Guide to the Markets illustrates a comprehensive array of market and economic histories, trends, and statistics through clear charts and graphs. For more information on the guide, visit our website at jpmorgan.com/GTM.
What aren't we talking about? We talked about trade policy, fiscal policy, deregulation. What else is relevant at a macro investing kind of context?
Yeah. One thing that's been on our minds is the government-sponsored enterprises. This is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These are very important institutions, right? Like, I think agency MBS is about two-thirds of the single-family mortgage market, about $9 trillion. Of course, housing is extremely important to the economy. It's about a sixth of the economy, if I'm right. So these are extremely important institutions to get right. And you'll remember that after the global financial crisis, well, during the global financial crisis, they were put in conservatorship, given the housing crisis. And they've been in conservatorship ever since. Now, the fear that we have is that there's going to be a rushed exit out of conservatorship for these two entities, and that's going to blow out mortgage spreads. And that's going to be a very significant development that we've been looking at. So we've been focused on that very closely.
Maybe there's an initial announcement by the end of the year, and then this could take a while.
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah, I definitely don't hear as much discussion about that one.
Yeah.
You have such a great background, so much experience in the policy world. You've mentioned a couple of key legislation that you were involved in and seeing the actual implementation and the effects. Any cool stories from your policy background, and how has the transition to the investment world been?
Oh, it's been great. I get to work with folks like you, Gabby, and on a day-to-day basis. So it's been great. I mean, my first job at Treasury was implementing this huge stimulus package. You know, Treasury got $1 trillion out of the $1.9 trillion in the American Rescue Plan. I was lucky enough to be part of the team that was really on the ground on essentially day one implementing that. And as you can imagine, this was a national emergency. It's, you know, we're right here. We forget we used to be socially distanced.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. And so a lot of the work we actually done remotely. Wow. But it was a COVID economic response team. And we were trying to provide economic relief to not just households, but state and local governments, mm-hmm. businesses, and the like. Huge operational risk. Operational lift mm-hmm. in terms of actually getting the money out the door. And also extremely important to get right policy-wise. What type of spending are we incentivizing, more short-term, more investments? But that was something that when you look back at the COVID recovery, which has been was pretty strong, that's something we can look back and said, hey, this really had an impact.
It's such an impact, and you had to do it so quickly, right? You didn't have endless time to get it just perfect.
Exactly. That's right.
Incredible.
So that was my first job at Treasury. My last job was as Deputy Chief of Staff to Secretary Yellen. I have to mention that because Secretary Yellen is, you know, I feel like I was in the shadow of greatness in a way. You know, getting to work for her on kind of a broad policy portfolio, whether it's crisis response or macro issues or, you know, issues around insurance markets, housing markets, financial markets, was a true privilege.
Wow, that's incredible. I've seen her speak once, and I thought that was cool. But getting to work side by side and learn from her, that's really interesting.
Yes.
So we're lucky to have you. And the last question I have, it's our typical bonus round. That we ask all of our guests. And if you had a book, a journal, a podcast, a movie that you'd recommend people go and read and see and follow, what would it be? Just to get a better understanding of the policy macro world. Yeah. So one external and then one JP Morgan resource.
Yeah. So I would say externally, I'm a huge believer in reading history versus reading theory. I think both are very important and have their place. But for me, I always like history because it's about the facts. It's about what actually happened versus theory is someone's take on the facts or what might happen in the future. So in terms of economic history and related to policy, I've loved Adam Tooze's work. So he actually used to be a professor of mine back in college. And he's a great economic historian. He's written a number of books on crisis moments. One, for example, is Crashed, which I believe was about the global financial crisis. He wrote one also on the COVID crisis mm-hmm. and the government intervention during those times. And so I'd highly recommend folks check that out. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of internal JP Morgan resources, what I love is the long-term capital market assumptions. And Gabby, I know that you're intimately involved with them, but these are basically long-term forecasts for a bunch of asset classes. And what I think is great is we do what's best on about JP Morgan is we use the breadth of our expertise and the depth of our expertise. It's not just the multi-asset team working on this, not just Market Insights working on this. It's the equities analysts, right, who are very deep into their individual stocks, individual portfolios. It's fixed income folks. It's the alternative folks really coming together as one team and bring all that JP Morgan has to offer to produce these forecasts. And they've had a great track record in terms of accuracy over the years. And what I also love about them is that there's a methodology handbook. Mm-hmm. So you can actually read about how we come up with these forecasts. And I think both understand the process as well as the final product. I think it's remarkable and everyone should take a look.
It's one of my favorite things also. So many of the themes you mentioned, we tease out there, right? Economic
exactly.
nationalism, fiscal activism.
Exactly. And we discuss how they turn into specific numbers.
Yeah.
For asset class forecasts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you did not mention the Treasury statement.
Yeah, the Treasury
statement. Maybe that's a bonus.
Exactly.
The third one you'd recommend. Well, thank you so much, gang, for joining us. And thank you for listening and watching. Make sure to look out for more Insights Now episodes in this feed. See you soon.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed J.P. Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Co. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.